take two of the Barrington StoryCorps project, or the Barrington Historic Project, speaking kind of project or whatever. So I'm Rob Widener, and
Norval Stevens,
and
we his grandfather,
my grandfather, and we're here for take one of or take two, but hopefully the this thing and everything will work out smoothly. So first off, we're just going to talk a little bit about your childhood, Grampy, kind of how you were raised. How your relationship with your parents were. You traveled a little bit, I believe, and so why don't you just start off a little bit about?
Well, some background. I basically grew up in Englewood area in Chicago. That's roughly the corner of 68th South and Stewart, Englewood area. When I was first aware of it, I realized I was in an area almost entirely homes. Some of the main roads had some apartments on them. The homes were largely built in the late 1800s. And my grandfather was a judge of the Superior Court of Chicago, which is an appellate court. My other grandfather was an entrepreneur, developed hotels, had a business school. He was Scots. The other side of my family is English and Welsh. My mother was a school teacher. She graduated from the University of Illinois. And my father was in real estate for Walgreens, and he had graduated from the University of Wisconsin. And both of them were in, my mother was in a sorority, Pi Beta Phi, and my dad was a Delta Tau Delta. So I was just aware of this leafy, old tree area when I was growing up. We had one year that we were, during the Depression, when we went to Elizabeth, New Jersey. But other than that, I grew up on the South Side. My folks were very active in the Englewood Baptist Church. There was no question as to where we would be on a Sunday morning. But on the way home, we would stop at the Walgreens drugstore across the street from the church and pick up a pint of ice cream, which my mother would then quarter. Each of the family got a quarter, Dad and Mother and my brother John. It was an easy life as I look back on it. After dinner or even during the day, we could walk as far, one block away, to the playground at Parker Grammar School and High School, where I went to for 12 years. And there were ball diamonds and games that we used to play against the wall. There was never any question. We would be gone back by noon for lunch, wherever we were. Usually had to tell Mother where we were going to be. After dinner, very frequently went over to the playground, played another game of Chicago softball, which is with a 16-inch ball, not a 12-inch ball. So I look back at it as an easy time. There were two libraries, public libraries, in the same distance, about a mile away. So if you wanted a book that you didn't have, it was easy to get. And I don't think my brother or I ever thought that we were in a depression or that we didn't have everything we wanted. We learned later that we were. Sunday night, Mother would come in sometimes clapping her hands and say, "Dearies, we're going to have toast and bread and sugar for Sunday dinner." And I learned later from my dad, he said, a good number of times there was more week left at the end of the money, and that was all we had. We might have a glass of milk and bread or toast, and that was it. But if it happened to be a pretty good day, and White Castle had advertised 13 White Castles for a dollar, my brother and I would get on our bikes and ride about three blocks to the nearest White Castle, and that would be Sunday dinner. So it was a happy time to grow up. And as I learned later, the school, Parker High School, was well regarded. I had Latin, and we could have had up through trigonometry and mathematics in this school. We had a full chemistry lab, which is very unusual today anyway. And I realized much later how fortunate we were. Mm. And it would, to have that kind of education today in Chicago is probably impossible.
Yeah.
Mother told me that I was going to go to DePauw University, that I would get a scholarship there. Well, I didn't know that, but I went there. The scholarship was the Rector Scholarship, and it was a full ride to DePauw. And on graduation, you got a check for $250, which was what a semester cost, my first semester there.
Oh, wow.
So up to, let's say, about 18, summers were spent as much time as we could up at the lake, in Hamlin Lake in Ludington, Michigan, where my grandfather had had a beautiful home on 4 acres on the lake with a marvelous frame cottage, they called it in the language of the times. But it was, when it was built, it had five bedrooms, living room, dining area, and on the third floor, not only storage, but a place for the chauffeur. My grandfather, on $15,000 worth of income then, in the 20s, had two cars, a maid, a chauffeur, and two homes.
Hmm.
I've calculated later that today it would take an income of at least $370,000 to $400,000 to have what he had back then. So life was easy. However, my grandfather died in 1936, and that, of course, made a big difference in the family. As a result, we moved in with him, with my grandmother, and literally Dad managed the both the whole family.
Mm.
And on a very meager will that he had left for Nellie, my grandmother, we got through the Depression and, if you will, into the war. And it was, I look back on it, we never had any hardships.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I will remember, the summer of 1942, Pearl Harbor had been December 7, 41, gas rationing, speed limit of 35 miles an hour. We went up to the lake for 2 weeks, and that was all. I remember it very well because, and it may have been a signal for the future, on the 7th of August in 1942, we were driving home, listening on the radio to the stories that the Marines had landed at Guadalcanal. Little did I know, later I'd be living that story.
Mm.
Well, that was a childhood of a very pleasant one, and one that I look back, I still have friends, three or four friends from that time that go way back.
Mm-hmm. Now, did you know what you wanted to study at DePauw before you got there, or like when you were in high school?
Probably. Literally, at that time, if you went into a liberal arts college, you were expected not to be thinking of a career, at mm-hmm. least not yet. Get there, get settled, see what you like, see where you do excel, and do some planning on that basis. But at that time, there was no career guidance. I don't think, probably very few of the liberal arts colleges were doing anything like that. So no, I didn't know what I wanted to do. And having lived through a war, we certainly knew how to cope with a war. But we didn't expect that there'd be another one
mm-hmm.
anyway. So that life was easy. As I mentioned, DePauw was $500 a year plus room and board.
Yeah.
So it was an almost idyllic time. You could plan ahead, dream ahead, and as most of the people at the time said, beautiful, wealthy girls went to DePauw to marry bright guys that had Rector Scholars.
Yeah.
Because there were, 25 to 30 Rector Scholars a year, full ride, almost all of them valedictorians mm-hmm. of their class. And I know when we graduated, I think, as I remember, there were 87 women in the class who were engaged, including your grandmother.
Exactly.
She was the president of the Theta House, and I had decided sometime in my junior year I would probably die a hermit if I didn't find a bride here. So I had a rather strong campaign to win her away from a couple of other
exactly.
men who had the same idea.
Exactly. And you came out on top, which is always good.
Well, we know I did.
Now, so as we kind of talked about your transition to college, your transition out of college kind of took a turn a little bit when you realized that you wanted to go into the
well, the draft was still on.
Yeah.
So all of us knew that we were likely to be drafted, and we were deferred as long as we were in college.
Mm-hmm.
But during my sophomore year, in the spring of that year, the Marines were on campus, and several of us went over to meet and listen to them. And they had a very interesting proposition, one that I think was aimed at appealing to liberal arts colleges and ones that were known as being academically rigorous.
Mm-hmm.
If you were called up, it was 8 years of service. Usually 3 years of active duty and 5 years reserve. The Marines came in with two propositions. Number one, the United States military has always trained to fight the last war. And we have no idea what the next war is going to be. So we're not going to concentrate on amphibious warfare. It just happened we were given the Pacific mm-hmm. in the Second World War. Who knows where it might be next time. So we'll make you a deal. Join the Marine Corps, 2 years active duty, 6 years reserve, not 3 years active duty if you're called up, and you will be prepared to lead men. However, you'll have to give up two of your next three summers, 6 weeks at Quantico. And that seemed a little bit appealing anyway, because at the time, other than a year that we had spent living in Elizabeth, New Jersey, I hadn't done any traveling. I'd never been on an airplane. So off we went in the first of the two summers. And there we were at Quantico and in the midst of all of the history of the United States Marine Corps. And what they said is, we'll never get you as physically fit as the men you command will be, but you will be prepared to lead them, and you will have the skills to lead them, and they will respect you.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to make sure of that both ways.
Yeah.
And it was incredible how well the Marine Corps did that. So the first 6 weeks, most of the time in class and on the rifle range, the Marines want you to be able to pick up and use any weapon you find on the battlefield.
Huh.
So the first year was almost, it was entirely on the three basic weapons that the Marine Corps had at the time, the Browning Automatic Rifle, BAR, which was a belt-fed, really heavy-duty battle rifle, automatic rifle, the Garand, the M1, and the M1 carbine. We also learned to and had to qualify on the 45 caliber pistol, which is a very inaccurate weapon beyond this wall almost. And I was top on all three of those. I got the highest scores. And I never had to use that in battle, but it took me back to the days when my father enrolled both John and me, my brother, in the YMCA. And in those days, the YMCA had a rifle range, 22 rifle range. So I had learned to use that weapon well, and I think I'm no more than qualified. I got to the top grades in all three of those major weapons that we had. And we had a great deal, the second year especially, a great deal of maneuvers where we were led against the school's troops and got a sense of what it was going to be like.
Yeah.
Plus a whole lot of marching because the Marines believe in a whole lot of close order drill.
Yeah.
So there I was after two summers thinking this could be it. All I have now is up to 8 years in the reserves.
Yeah.
Then came June of 1950 when North Korea went over the line, and we all knew immediately we're going to be called up.
Yeah.
My best friend during that time, Herb Hoover, who's still a good friend, was doing his second summer that summer, and we were all figuring that they'll just keep him and send him away. No, everybody, the Marines met their commitment. You went back, you could finish school. I had started in February in the spring semester because I had been double promoted along the way. So I would have graduated in the end of January of 1951. So I very carefully read my enlistment in the Marine Corps, and it said that I was to inform the Marine Corps the date that my class would graduate.
Mm.
So that meant that my class of 1951 would graduate in June.
Yeah.
Well, at the time, I was engaged to Diane. We hadn't set any dates, but we had decided that we were going to be a couple. That last semester, my ninth semester at DePauw, I went into the Rector Scholarship Foundation and said, I want to stay another semester, but I have to take two courses in order to be considered a student. So here are the two courses that I want to take. And is there anything that I could do?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it happened that I had been the first chairman of the Union Building, which was brand new, was being built our senior year. And I had been responsible for writing the charter for it from the student standpoint, doing the initial programming, figuring out what we were going to do in the building. And the offer came through from the university, then you'll be the assistant director of the Union Building and the assistant director of alumni relations.
Mm-hmm.
And I got an office in the Union Building, bigger than any office I had for dozens of years.
Awesome.
So I spent the last semester working and going to school, and whenever Diane didn't have a class or would come over, she would come over and mm-hmm. sit in my office, and we'd theoretically talk or work so that I put in a full day. Stayed at the fraternity house and had to stay to the end of June because that was the all the employment agreements that universities usually run through June.
Yeah.
So we graduated. Diane went home to Milwaukee, and I planned to stay until the last day of June. And the plan was then that Diane would come down from Milwaukee to Chicago. Dad would meet her, and would drive to the Englewood station where I would get off the train from Greencastle,
mm-hmm.
and we would drive to the lake. And the lake had been opened by then, but by workers that we had. And Dad had gone up to see to it that it was open. But here we were about 1st of July up at the lake. And I think it was the first full day we were there. Dad said, I got a letter from the Marine Corps for you. You two might want to see what it says. He hadn't opened it. So we went down on the lawn, but just off the stairs that go off to the west, the little knoll that's there, and opened the letter. And it was ordering me to report to the the President of the United States directs that you report for duty to Quantico, Virginia, United States Marine Corps Barracks, as of October 1951. Mm-hmm. So we said, oh, well, I said, we shouldn't get married with this coming up. And she said, no, we will get married. You'll be okay. So we got married 1 week before we were to report at Quantico. Had a honeymoon in Virginia, wonderful tideland Virginia. And on that Monday morning, the 6th of October, we were there to be sworn in.
Yeah.
And do all the things that you have to do.
Yeah.
Start a home, place, find some place to live, all the other things that go into it.
Yeah.
We were lucky. We found an apartment in Alexandria, Virginia. Found another member in my class who had a car, so we didn't have to buy a car. And I rented or paid him money to take us in, since we were in the same class and virtually the same name, since, that is to say, the Marines do everything by alphabet. So if I had met somebody who was an Alexander rather than a Stevens, he'd been on a...
Wouldn't have been convenient.
But as I recall, my ride was an R. So by and large, the end of the alphabet did all the same things together. Then had proceeded to have 5 months of additional training. October, November, December, January, February, and even into March before we graduated. And late in the program, there were about, I would say, 300 men probably in our 11th SBC. And they called about 20 or 25 of us together, just called out by name and said, meet after class. And they said to the group of us, you are all the leaders. You've got the high marks here. You've been elected by your, when it happens, you're the ones that are picked to lead. So don't any of you go for motor pool or counterintelligence or something like that. You are going to choose combat MOSs, MOS, military occupation specialty. And they just named what the specialties would be. It would have to be in infantry or artillery or something like that. So I chose artillery, figuring, gosh, that sounds like fun. Maybe I'll be behind the lines doing that. The result was that I was assigned to the class that started roughly the first day of July, and it was only at that time April. So I had another, oh heavens, 2 or 3 months of doing nothing but shuffling papers and keep them busy job. So then Diane and I, we went back home. We had a month off. And then I had to report to Fort Sill, Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. Great experience. We drove in, and as we went down one of the roads, Cache Road, C-A-C-H-E, miners and Indians not served at one of the bars as we came in. So we knew we were in a different territory.
Certainly.
It was certainly a wonderful experience. The Marines were very much in the minority. There were, out of a class of probably 120, there were 7 Marines in the class, including one captain who had battlefield promotions from enlisted man in the batteries up through all of the non-commissioned ranks and was going to field commission as a second lieutenant. He was sent back to Fort Sill because he had had no formal artillery training. Well, he was not only a great mentor, but was the only combat veteran, as I remember, in that class. We probably had 10 men anyway, who had just graduated from West Point, all the same age as the rest of us, and probably the same number from Annapolis, men who were going to go into the Marine Corps. So we knew we had some competition, the rest of us who had gone to liberal arts colleges. And even though the Marines who were there had also had the 12 weeks of Marine training, and then most of us another 5 or 6 months of training, we were in with men who'd spent 4 years basically in training for the military. Mm-hmm. Well, to the amazement of the those who'd come from the military academy, the top 10% of the class was evenly broken between those that went to West Point or Annapolis and those of us who had just gone to, if you will, liberal arts colleges. Mm-hmm. And I think that was, it proved to be true even later when we were in Korea. I would not give anything not to have been to those schools, but I think the Marine Corps was so intent on making sure you were ready to command men that we were ready when we got there.
Yeah.
After Fort Sill, we were directed to Camp Pendleton, Oceanside, California. But we had, I think, about 10 days to get there. So we decided to take a side trip to Mexico. And at the time, Walgreens had a store in Mexico City called Sanborns. And Dad arranged for me to go in and meet the manager who took us to lunch and was a really high-born Mexican. We saw a side trip, $99, 3 days, 2 nights in Acapulco. So we literally went over there. We rented surfboards and paddled out from the beach to an island, and then decided that we wanted to paddle to see, look into Acapulco Bay. We got caught in the tide and really got scared and paddled our arms off to get back in behind the island and then to the beach, and got severely sunburned. So severely sunburned that we both slept nude.
Ouch.
Flat on our faces because our backs were just burnt red.
Yeah.
Well, off then to Camp Pendleton, and as the Marine says, now we'll tell you really how to handle artillery. Very good training again, and shortly after our anniversary, the 29th of September, off we went in 1952 to Korea. And unless I'm taking you off track, I'll keep talking.
No, so yeah, so I mean, what kind of your track that you went on in the Marines was certainly kind of different than everyone else's. You kind of got
Well, for a couple of reasons. on the ship that we boarded in San Diego, first day out, there was a bulletin that was handed around saying there'll be a ship's newspaper, and do we have any volunteers to handle the ship's newspaper? And I thought, gosh, you know, 15 days at sea, and so there'd be something to do.
Yeah, exactly.
Have news flashes, and I could put together the... So I volunteered to be on it, and I think I was the only officer. And there must have been, I don't know, 3,000 Marines going over. It was full. There was, I had an office, we had typewriters and mimeographs so that we could put out a newspaper. In the middle of the trip over, about literally about the middle, we ran into a typhoon, same as a hurricane, right head on, and went through one agonizing day when we were locked down. It was so bad that the brig, which was in the bow of the ship, would come out of the water and then pound in. And they literally had to take the men out of the brig because the first night, that one of them had a broken rib and one of them had a broken arm just being smashed against the bulkhead. But at the same time, when it was digging its bow in, the screw would come out. So the propellers would be whirling away in the air, just shaking the ship. It was a very bad time. Fortunately, where I slept, or there were about 8 or 9 officers that had officers' quarters, and the office from which we did the newspaper was just literally right down the way. When we had, there was a lull, I got down enough to put out the paper for that day. And as we neared Japan, and ship's crew member came down and handed me an envelope and said, I'm to wait to get an answer. And I opened it up, and I was being invited to dinner with the captain of the ship. Obviously, I didn't have any clothes other than combat clothes, so I appeared and sat down and was served dinner with the captain. Very interesting guy, and talked about his many crossings. And he just said, toward the end of the meal, Arthur Ox Sulzberger of the New York Times family was the editor of the last newspaper on the way over, and it was an outstanding newspaper. Yours was better. And he said, I'm going to put a note in your jacket to that effect. And he said, they tell me that here's something you're going to need, and it's a ballpoint pen, because you're not going to be able to find them in Korea. And good luck, Lieutenant. So 2 days, that night, we landed in Kobe, and Marines were released onto that unsuspecting city. And the next day, we weighed anchor and headed for Incheon, where the main landing had occurred about 6 months before, and when the Marines had leapfrogged from Pusan, which was right at the tip of the peninsula, outflanked the North Koreans and literally brought the Chinese in on us up at the Chosin Reservoir. By that time, the Marines had been moved to the west coast, anchoring the line, and right on the road between Seoul and capital of Pyongyang, the capital of North Korea. And that's where my first assignment was as an artillery officer. At the time, I was east of Panmunjom, not by very much. I couldn't quite see it around the corner, but we knew where it was. And had an interesting first day experience. And I don't know whether I mentioned this last time. I took over squad, and that first night, the captain of the company, a veteran of the Pacific Wars and highly regarded, everybody said he was one of the best infantry commanders that Marines had, brought me in as it was getting dark. This would be in October, and said, this is your first night. Please hand me your carbine. And the corporal here will put you in a cave tonight. I'm not going to risk you with my Marines. If there's some reason you would need your weapon, corporal here will have it for you. But you're going in a cave. You can sleep there tonight.
All by yourself, huh?
All alone. See you in the morning. Yes, sir. Went in. And there was some small arms fire. I mean, the Marines outside were firing, and I could hear rifle fire. I thought, Lord, And then I thought, I know exactly what this guy is doing to me. He's playing a mind game.
Yeah.
If I go in the morning and say I couldn't sleep a wink, I'm going to be back here another night. So I figured, he's right. There are Marines outside. If they needed another man in the trenches, they'd come and get me. So I went to sleep.
Yeah.
Woke in the morning, went out to have breakfast, and Captain called me in and said, well, how'd it go? And I said, well, I heard the fire, small arms fire, and I knew something was going on, but...
Put me right to sleep.
I figured I better get some sleep, so I went to sleep. Corporal, give the lieutenant his weapon. So I was then taken to the bunker that was our observation post. We had behind it was the squad cave where we lived, but this was up on the forward side of the hill and had two very heavy, probably 10, 12 feet long logs that were probably 12 inches thick. And there was just a slit about 6 inches wide where we looked out over the battlefield. And the sergeant, who was my crew chief, got to talking, and I said, what happened to the guy ahead of me? And he said, well, a Chinese put a round right through this window, and it went off back there and killed my predecessor and yours. I said, well, where's that coming from? And he said, well, you know, we got it. And he said, you see that hill down there? They've hollowed that hill out, and they roll out a 76 and take it. And they know, obviously, they know where this is. Somebody had the binoculars out in the afternoon, and it shined a white, you know, a light off the middle of a hill.
Yeah.
And they fire at us all the time. And at that moment, and we could tell it was coming our way. We went down.
Yeah.
And the shell landed 5 or 6 feet in front of us and put dirt on the back of my neck. And I said, you know where that hill is. Show me again. I said, well, we're going to take that out. And he said, we've fired at it before. And I said, well, you haven't done the way I'm going to do it. So I called up a tank. And the tank had a 90-millimeter rifle cannon on it. I went to the tank commander and said, you know, there's the hill. Bore sight down that thing, and then do whatever you have to do to allow for the fade of the shell. I'm going forward. I'm going to get out ahead of the front lines. I'm going to go out to an outpost where I can see that damn thing, and we're going to take care of this hill.
Yeah.
So I got a Jeep driver, and I remember as we went out, went behind a sort of a hillock, and the driver stopped. I said, what are you driving? And he said, they're watching us. I don't want something waiting for us when we come around here, because they've got time. Didn't happen. So we went forward. There were guys in slip trenches out there, and I could sight in on the hill. And I said, okay, let's do one. And I heard the tank fire, and it was darn near where it should have been. I said, just up a bit and blow the top off that hill.
Yeah.
And the next one, I saw the wheel from that other cannon, cartwheeling out another debris coming off. And we literally took the top off that hill, got back in, and drove back as fast as we could. And sure enough, as we came around, they had put a mortar shell right on the spot where we'd been waiting.
Oh, wow.
So got back, and... that was the most excitement I had front line. Later, it was December. I was in the middle of bringing in artillery support. We were in a firefight, and the incoming had knocked out one of my lines back to the battery, which was about 1,500 yards back. And so I was operating the calling in the shots by telephone, and I had a wire team out replacing the line so that we could We weren't just dependent on the radio. And the phone rang. And I was trying to keep the phone line open because in case the radios weren't working, I could at least call back. And it was a major, said Lieutenant Stevens. I said, damn it, yeah. I'm in the middle of a firefight. I just can't talk to you now. And he said,
sir,
understand. I'm sorry. I should have looked. Yeah. I didn't see there was any action tonight. Call me when it's over. Well, it got over about midnight and quieted down, and I thought, I am going to get eaten out for swearing at a senior officer. So about 1 o'clock, I called. The major was still there, and I started off apologizing. He said, stop, my fault. We can talk about it in the morning, but don't even worry about it. There'll be a chief to pick you up at 0730 and bring you back to artillery headquarters. Now, I didn't know what that meant, but I couldn't imagine from his tone that I was really going to be reprimanded. And sat down with the major and the colonel, who was in charge of all the Marine artillery. And they said, you're the man we've been looking for. In your jacket is a report that you handled a newspaper, and it was the best newspaper that the captain had had. Well, that's going to be your cover. You're going to be the public information officer of the regiment. There are three battalions to a regiment in the case of the Marine Corps. There would be three Marine batteries, 6 guns each. You'll be here at headquarters, but that'll be your cover. You're going to be our atomic warfare officer for the regiment, which merely means you'll be briefed on what our atomic capabilities are here, and you will be responsible for training all of our men in protective measures to take if the Chinese, which we were facing at the time, if they got an atomic bomb from the Russians. Mm-hmm. The Chinese didn't have it at the time. But you're going to have to go back for school. And they said you'll be departing here roughly, as I recall, 18th or 19th of December. And you'll have a new assignment when you come back. You'll not be on the front lines. Mm-hmm. From now on, you cannot be on the front lines.
Yeah.
So I went back to Japan, and it turned out that it was Christmas holiday. So instead of 2 weeks of school, I had a week of school, a week off, mm-hmm. and another week of school. And it was a wonderful time to be there. It was. The winter is not severe in Japan, but we could have, during that intervening week, we could have time off.
Yeah.
And did. But what I immediately did when we got back to Japan, the only way to get messages home then was by ham radio. Mm-hmm. So I went in, and this would have been just about Christmas, and there was a ham radio operator there, and I could tell him my story, write it out, and he would call from Japan to Alaska. Ham radio operator would pick it up in Alaska, send it, as I recall, to a ham radio operator in either Wyoming or Montana, who would then relay it to a ham operator wherever your home was.
Yeah.
So relayed it to Milwaukee, and on, I think, Christmas Eve, the phone rang at the Forrest home in Milwaukee. Diane was living with her parents in Milwaukee, and picked up the phone, and her father answered it and said, it's for you. And so she was handled the phone, listened, and then her first remark was, oh, no. And her mother upstairs, leaning over, listening, shrieked and was afraid that, you know, it was bad news. And then, as she said, Diane was crying and laughing at the same time, but said, he's okay. And all the ham operator could do would be to read what he'd gotten, that I'm in Japan, I'll be here for a week. And in fact, I'll be here for 3 weeks, but about a week off, and I'll try to get to you one more time. Merry Christmas, whatever it was. So that proved to be a very interesting time. Just one other marvelous memory of the time. Another friend of mine who was in the school and I decided that we would go to Tokyo. And it was a way to do it in a day, quick trip. And so we looked to see what train line we took in, trying to remember all of the characters, and exactly how long it took to get in. It was a 25-minute ride to get to the main train station. So we spent our time there and came back and got down the same track that we thought that we'd come out on, got on the train, and went for 25 minutes, and whenever they called the next station,
we got off.
It wasn't the right place. We were wandering around not far from the station when a little Japanese woman, literally in kimono, came up to us and bowed and said, "May I help you?" Perfect English. And we said, "Oh, can you help us? We're supposed to be at the air station at Gifu." And she said, "Well, it's just the next train line over. My cousin is a taxi driver. I'll call him and you can, he'll take you over there."
Perfect.
And we said, "You speak perfect English. How come?" And she said, "Berkeley, 1936. So even, it was amazing, even back then, and this is after the war, and she was, now, by that time, we were well accepted in Japan, but mm-hmm. there were bitter feelings.
Yeah.
It was a marvelous experience. Finished out the time, came back. That one episode where the shell landed near me was the last time I was anywhere near any incoming.
That's good.
Came back and decided to look for a job. But that got us up to that time. What else do you want to talk about? Finding the family, building it? Because we're back.
It's about time, yeah. I mean, we could talk for weeks, I'm sure.
At any rate, we had kids, as you know.
Yeah.
Five children. And a marvelous marriage that, while they all have some rocky moments, I don't think anything ever got to more than... We just agreed at the beginning that each of us in a disagreement would go 60% of the way, which often ended up with us trading sides because, no, it isn't that important, which was, I think, great advice to think about for the future with you.
Certainly.
But we did our best all along to recognize what especially my father had done.
Yeah.
Save.
Certainly.
And we did. And today I think you're getting the benefit of knowing
that I am.
From the very beginning we have saved and prepared for the next generation. And in our case, we've done it even to mm-hmm. your level.
Yep.
We want to make sure that you have every opportunity we had. Being in Barrington, I think, has been a real benefit for us. It's a, as you know,
mm-hmm.
this is a town with a heart. There's more civic activity around making this a great place to live.
Mm-hmm.
And we've tried to do everything we can to extend that
yeah.
as part of what we really believe is part of being a citizen of this community.
Yeah.
And interestingly, what we're doing is part of a project of the Barrington Area Development Council that I've been in for, I think, 30 years.
Yeah. Yeah, well, hopefully other people will be doing the same thing, sharing stories and everything and making this community a great community.
I hope so. And thank you for being part of it.
Of course. It's my pleasure. So that was hopefully last time we'll have to do this.
Are we at 50 minutes? Is that what it is?
Yeah, I started a little bit late, but...